You are listening to Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling in video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I'm Max Folkman. Today's guests are Emily Garrison and Julie Marchiori. Emily is a narrative designer at Telltale Games and has worked on The Walking Dead Michonne, along with Batman, and previously designed and wrote educational games at Cognito. Julie is a level designer, mission designer, and current assistant narrative director at Ubisoft Montreal, and has worked on such games as Army of Two and its sequel, The 40th Day, Far Cry 3, Assassin's Creed 3, and Assassin's Creed Unity. Welcome to the show, you two.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So we'll start with how you two broke into games. So Emily, would you want to go first?
Sure. My route of breaking into games was actually a bit odd. I had gone to undergrad for acting, which is not particularly related to games. But as I discovered in my quest to find a game job, acting actually was more related to narrative design than I could have possibly expected. I, like I said, studied acting and then was an acting teacher, both for kids and adults, for a long time. And I went back to get a graduate degree. I was going to Brooklyn College in New York. And there they had a focus on educational gaming in their Masters of Education. And I took that path. And before I graduated, I was able to land a design job at Cognito. I dropped out, and it's been a pretty smooth road since then.
Was that an easy switch for you?
Kind of, actually. By the time I graduated with my degree in acting, I knew I didn't really want to be an actor. I had performed in a number of regional productions and small films and such as a teenager. So when it came to college, I didn't really think about it. It was the thing I was good at, so I figured I'd pursue a degree in it. Video game degrees weren't a thing yet then, really. So going to school for video games wasn't an option. But right. Once I realized that was something I could focus on, I've loved video games since I was a kid. I played a lot of them. I was always interested in video game design. I'd written quite a few tabletop RPG settings myself, including a tabletop RPG book for kids. So it was a pretty smooth transition.
And how did you become a narrative designer?
So for me, I actually focused on that while I was working at Cognito. They had initially hired me as a junior instructional designer. And at Cognito, instructional design encompasses both their writing and design departments. And as I became a more trusted member of their staff, I ended up focusing mostly on narrative design, the flow of the story of their games. And then when I knew I wanted to move out of New York, that was the type of position I applied to at other gaming companies. And luckily enough, I got picked up by Telltale.
Awesome. Julie, how'd you break in?
Well, I don't think there's... I'd say my break-in was also odd, because I studied in literature, both, masters, and I went directly into copywriting. But at one point, I felt that I needed to do more. I wanted to interact with the public and not just state stuff. So I went and did a special class in interactive script writing, and that was back in 2005, so it was before the 2.0 bubble. At that point, nothing was really interacting with anything. I mean, games were pretty linear, although I always loved them. I mean, I have Zork and Pac-Man and that stuff branded in my DNA. So anyway, so I went back, and right away I was picked up by EA after I finished the interactive script writing class as a level designer. So I was technically building the sets and staging the story, but I was never involved into the story that much. But all through the years, I wanted to get more and more involved because I felt I could do something there, do something interesting. And when I joined Ubisoft, that's where I actually did the narrative switch. And eventually, I think it was more during AC3, we were building these huge, rich, beautiful environments that are just calling for content. And we provide an amazing campaign for the player to play. But once the campaign's done, I mean, the world is still there begging for agency. And I began to be very vocal about the fact that I thought we could give more contextualization to our world so that the player could find his own story within the world. And I did a little of that in ACU. And for the past 3 years, I've been solely working on that kind of stuff, and it's been great.
Okay, so I have a couple of questions that some of them we'll get to later, but first, what was that interactive script running class like?
It's one of the, like, it's funny because Emily was talking about acting school, right? Mm-hmm. And here in Montreal, we have a school called INIS. National Institute of Sound and Image. And a lot of people from television and movie locally here come from that school. And in 2005, I saw a commercial on TV, and it was for the new class they had in interactive media. And I was like, I got to do this. And you give yourself soul, body and soul, for about 6-7 months, and you dive into the interactive script writing, and you literally like just eat and breathe it like 24/7 for 6-7 months. And so at that point, because the class changed a lot because it adapted to the reality of the industry, but at that point we did a lot of web ARG, for instance, interactive museums, and video games, of course.
This is a really open-ended question, and it can be for both of you, if Emily, if you have any thoughts on it. But as a narrative designer, how do you empower the player to build their own stories?
Would you like to go first, or?
Sure. Well, I think the magic word is always agency, which Julie said just a moment ago. We have to create situations in which the player either absolutely is empowered to decide what happens next, what they want to say and do, or at least, especially at Telltale, they feel like they are absolutely empowered to decide what happens next. As much as possible, to make a story that is driven by the player character, even if the player isn't clicking a button, that their character is the one driving the story forward. At least for me, I'm in writers' rooms a lot. We work very, very closely with our writers at Telltale to create situations in which the player character is the one who does every important plot-driving moment. We often will go over scripts written by writers and say, can't the player do that? Even if there's not a button press, just handing that over to the avatar that the player recognizes.
Do you have methods that you fall back to a lot for giving player agencies or giving them the illusion that they have agency, or do you usually invent new stuff on everything you do?
Well, the stance I'm in right now is that I no longer want to tell a story to anyone. I want someone to build a story with the fragments that I will litter the world with. I don't think the player needs to be told a story anymore. I think if we want to engage a player and immerse a player, he needs to be telling himself the story he's in, with the help of what we're gonna, the tools we're gonna give him to build a story. And that really falls back into the verbs that the player is allowed to express when he's playing. A lot of the games we're playing right now, the only verbs I can use to express myself in the world I'm in is shoot, kick, kill. And that doesn't build a very deep and immersive story, because, I mean, it always comes back to the same thing, right? I remember really enjoying playing the first Walking Dead by Telltale and deciding who I'm going to give my help bar to, because at that point it was something new. I could express myself in a choice. It wasn't kick, kill, an aggressive verb. It was really a choice that I could express myself in the world. So the past years, I've been trying to help the player use verbs that weren't really used before in our games, things that instead of having button presses that evaluate my physical either precision or accuracy or something, I mean, allowing the player to express himself not through physical challenge but mental challenge. And the thing with mental challenges is it's hard to validate that the player how the player resolved the challenge. I mean, how will you extract the thought process of the player on the couch with the help of a controller, right?
Yeah.
It's going to be by a button press, but is there anything else that we can actually do? And that's the empowering a player through story for me is providing the story bits out there and trying to have eureka moments happen in the brain of the player as he uncovers stories by himself.
I'd like to build off of what Julie said, if that's okay.
Yes,
please do. Please do.
Great. First of all, I do admit just saying button press sounded a bit callous, but of course, given the nature of the games that we make at Telltale, our main mechanics are pretty consistently choices and QTEs. So I tend to refer to it like that in a affectionate yet somewhat snarky way, if that makes sense. We don't have open world. One of the questions you had sent me, which you'll probably hit on more later, is what aspects of what Julie gets to do in narrative design do I wish I got to do more of? And that's certainly emergent storytelling. Because we're, like I said, we're not open world games. The paths you take in Telltale games, though very different a lot of the time, are moderately prescribed, if that makes sense. And that means when we're thinking about things like the verbs we're using, we have to be very specific. And that brings me back to what I mentioned earlier about how going to acting school prepared me to be a narrative designer more than I would have thought. In acting, at least the type of acting I studied, I went to New York University and studied at the Stella Adler Studio of Acting. So it was very Stanislavski-based. And most of what we looked at were verbs, or as they're called in that type of actions. So every time you're saying a line to another character, you're not just saying it, you're playing a psychological action on that person. You're begging them, you're pleading with them, you're flirting with them, something like that. And those types of actions, actually, I believe, for a player, can be much more powerful than physical actions such as shooting or kicking or stealing. Am I seducing this other character? Mm-hmm. Am I berating this other character? Those types of things produce strong emotions in the person picking to do them. And that, to me, is where the story really lies.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we get those verbs more often in big budget games?
Because they're hard. Honestly, it's we've been doing the shoot kick stuff for, 20 years now. We master it. We're good at it. When you get to the, am I engaging this character? Did I understand what's going on here? We're only in the beginning of discovering how to express those words in games, and how will, like I said, it's that for me the barrier is how do I capture the output from the player to that type of verbs, right? We're searching. I mean, we're looking at possibilities of how we can actually make it happen.
Yeah, it's newer, and also I believe in it's more time consuming.
It is
to create. If you create villains that have certain weapons in the game, and you assign AI to them, then you can populate levels. And I'm not saying that doesn't take skill. That takes an unbelievable amount of skill. But if you're coming up with, for example, a romance scene between two characters, every single moment of that scene has to be scripted really specifically to lead to different results at the end so that it feels natural. And that just takes an immense amount of time from designers, writers, depending on how you do it, cinematic artists, animators. It has to be very specific to that moment in the game.
Plus, I mean, there's a lot of research being done on, because you said at one point we thought that we could do a lot of content through very systemic processes. Mm-hmm. But then you realize that a lot of the content that's being produced systemically is not as engaging as what's, you know, really handcrafted. Mm-hmm. But yet you want to try to, you know, there might be systems underlying that we can use. So, I mean, the fun part right now is that we're experimenting. We're really trying to find systems that allow for enough customization for stories that are engaging enough to be created.
So do you think we'll get to a point where we'll have whole narratives created systemically and it'll be satisfying for players? Or is that still like a really long ways off or will never really happen at all?
You won't be able to have 100% systemic on that. I hope not, because it takes away so much from us that we want to create the custom content. But I'd like for instance, I don't know if we could systemically envision a system that balances like all the emotions of the NPCs in a world towards me, listening to actions that I made in the world, and they react accordingly. I mean, if we have a system that supports it, then we can start outputting more customized content to the player.
I agree. I think there are ways to use systems to make the process go faster, to get you to a certain point of like, oh, this is where the character could be in this moment. But there will always need to be a little bit of handcrafted towards the end, because each character needs to have their own personality.
Of course.
And I'm not sure that there's a way that a system could 100% plan for that.
No, I like to think that the system will help us listen to the player, listen mm-hmm. to what he's doing in the world, how he's resolving his conflict, and then we'll be able to craft the more customized content. And the system might detect, oh, well, his aggressivity is, you know, through the roof, so this player might react this way and output the content that we crafted.
Are there any games doing this well right now, or is this something that is still a ways off?
Well, I mean, if you look at the Nemesis system from the Lord of the Rings. Shadow of Mordor. I mean, it's getting there. I mean, when that came out, I mean, I literally only played the Nemesis system. I didn't play the game. I only played the Nemesis system because I was able to create my own stories. Is it something, it's something that emerged from, you know, from a game that wasn't pushing that system at the forefront. So, I mean, we're making some discoveries every day, I guess.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's the best example I can think of. A number of other games have done variable tracking with different characters. Obviously, Dragon Age Inquisition did that very transparently.
Yes.
And I think that was well done. But part of what I liked about the Nemesis system was that it did focus specifically on characters who saw what you had just done.
Mm-hmm.
In Dragon Age Inquisition, even characters who didn't come along for that mission had opinions that it then affected your relationships with them. Whereas in Shadow of Mordor, it was the characters who were right in front of you. And then I loved the visualizations every time you died or succeeded in that game and the different orcs moved up the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
That was just masterful.
Yeah, it was. But I also, like, one or the other, I know it's an old example, and I'm sure, like, I won't be the first guest to talk about it. But still, I mean, whenever I talk about the Eureka moment, the Eureka factor, the story version of it, not the scientific version of it, obviously, but in Fallout 3, when you get out of the vault and you're not even in Megaton, you're just in the first houses you see, and you open the mailbox and you see the letter and it says, well, dear sir, unfortunately, our vaults are full. We hope you have luck or whatever. And you get into the house and into the bed, there's this skeleton couple, you know, embracing. And I mean, right there, I mean, even if it's not attached to any quest, and even if it's not giving you any XP, or even if it's not doing anything, I mean, it says so much, and it happens in the brain of the player. I mean, the game doesn't tell you what happened. You recreate the story. If we can harness the power of that setup, I mean, powerful environmental storytelling, strong worlds, and inside the teams, I mean, us, we're a gigantic team. I mean, 400, 500, 600. If the world is not properly defined at the beginning, you can't expect a level designer to tell a tale of a world he doesn't know about. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's for the past 3 years, that's been my job, making sure her worlds are rich and coherent and dishing out the data to the teams so that they can feed off the same world, whether it's through game design or level design. And hopefully, if the world is so inspiring and if the world is so strong, then stories will come out in their work and the player will be able to use that.
You mentioned environmental storytelling. So I wanted to ask, because we haven't had a lot of level designers on here, and I know you haven't done it in a while, but what makes a good level? And with like story-based games, how do you tell stories through the level and environment instead of just with something like NPC interaction?
Well, I remember like the first years I think it was on the 40th day, like the second army of two, the levels were, well, they were funny. I was working on the zoo level, so it was, I had a lot of fun. And the results were, I mean, when you had a controller in your hands, it was really fun. But the level were really empty, and I was fascinated to see that the only people in the level were people you shoot. Nobody was living in the city. At one point, I tried putting an old lady NPC that was cleaning her floors, and I had to remove her because our systems weren't built to have any civilians, any characters, besides the NPCs you shoot. So we had a very, very good-looking Shanghai, but there was no story nowhere. I mean, it was just nice. But that was a while ago also. And at that point, we weren't as focused on environmental storytelling. If you look at the last BioShock, you go inside the stores at the beginning and there's not one store that has the same props in it. I mean, all the props in the stores are almost custom and they tell the story of what the store is about, who's owning the store, what the person is up to. That's something 10 years after how environmental storytelling evolved. Where I wish it goes, and there I'm going to talk about, because I'm a big fan of Baudrillard, in English, Baudrillard, yeah. Simulacra, where his notion of hyperreality is to have the same reality echoed everywhere so that the person that's in that reality is bombarded from all places with the same themes and notions and underlying stories, that it becomes the new reality. It becomes what she believes in. And if we can do that in a level, if you can, like, at the beginning when I start a world, I define five theme pillars, and I try to deconstruct all these pillars into as many teams as possible so that these teams can be picked up by artists, by level designers, and they just repeat it over and over and over so that when the player navigates a level, he receives these themes and these tropes, and it becomes his new reality because it's so consistent. All the stories happening, whether it's I wish I could quote a story here. I'm just gonna make one up, so it's not a real thing. But anyways, let's say in this world, ice cream is a really big thing, and it's the currency. Ice cream is currency. So if you have a level where every shop is an ice cream parlor, and everybody's having ice cream, and people are stealing like the poor, the ice cream man's truck everywhere. Eventually, you start feeling that the tropes of the world are all around you, and everything revolves around the same themes. And you start building stories with that. So that's a good level should echo the world, and the environmental storytelling should tell the stories of what happens in this world. Everywhere, wherever the player decides to put the camera, he should be able to tell a story of what he sees and how it affects his character or his avatar.
That just sounds very time-consuming.
the world-building thing?
You have to live with the world for a long time and have very pronounced thoughts about how everything works. And then
just to give you an idea, like not this project, but the previous one, I spent 6 months studying a place, a location in time, both politically, socially, artistically, historically, anthropologically. Thank you. And then after 6 months, they sent me 2 weeks to that distant, faraway place, and they told me, well, go infirm or confirm your theories. And I spent 2 weeks talking to people, visiting places, getting in trouble, and almost and not getting in trouble because I was having too much fun, but really because it wasn't. We really put ourselves out there, and it was fascinating. It was, we came back. I wasn't touching the ground anymore. I was soaring. It was. I call it the Hemingway period, where you actually you live it, you do it. And when you come back, I changed stuff that wasn't resonating with what I was doing, and what came out, I think it was a month after, was the Bible, the World Bible, and it was what we show the team. Well, this is what we're building, and they really took it from there. So yes, it's time consuming because it took a good 7-8 months, something like that. But it was really worth it, and we hope that it really shows in the next game.
Do you feel like 7 months is the proper amount of time, like a team should spend on that, or like should it be more or less?
Well, it could be less. Honestly, the first 6 months, it could have been a lot shorter.
How so?
Well, we were there was a lot of questions on the location and the period, the time period, the era. I mean, are we doing, you know, 2027-18, or are we doing 13-15? I mean, it was, okay. So we were questioning where we were going to position, in what year, technically, and where. So we did visit a lot of scenarios. And it's not just it's also like, what kind of universe are we building? Are we going fantasy? Are we going, you know, gritty? Are we, what's our tone? You know, just trying to define exactly what kind of universe we're trying to express. And really, it's a lot of projects are doing it at the same time because we're testing these methods, kind of. And it's fun because all the projects are really happening in different location and, I mean, time zones, and not time zones, but different times. And we're all advancing at the same time with these monumental universe. So it's really fun to compare and see how we're all going forward. But I mean, I think you could shorten it a lot, but us, it was really because of production issues that it took so long.
Okay.
And what is your design process like at Telltale?
For me, I'm definitely one of those people who prefers to do a lot of research, a lot of talking in writers' rooms, and then to sit down by myself at 11 p.m. in quiet and plot out as much as I can, and then go back and iterate on that. I'm definitely someone who tends to enjoy my first instinct with an idea, but then know that I need to change it a lot to get it to where it needs to be. If that makes sense, it might not. So I like seeing what my initial first take is, especially on character relationships and how to get them through a scene. But then there always needs to be a second level. Like if it's a scene where two characters are talking to each other, kind of like we were talking about with verbs earlier, talking is not particularly interesting, but needing to get something from that other character, well, and I'm just going to make this up completely, there's a volcanic explosion and lava is coming towards you and you also need to run away. That gets more interesting. And then if you know, like, their dog just died, that gets more interesting. We, as narrative designers at Telltale, do a lot of individual scene construction that then the dialogue is written by our writers. We have a process where we map it all out and then they go in and make it sing, and we pass it back and forth a number of times before it gets anywhere close to what goes out to players.
Are you doing passes on the actual dialogue, or is that mostly being rewritten by the writers?
So I almost never write dialogue. I have written like probably 10 lines in my entire tenure at Telltale. The designers write all of the display text that you see on the choices. We write all of the tutorial text, and we often write a lot of codex text and that type of thing. But the dialogue is almost exclusively writers. So when a line doesn't work with the design of the scene, I talk to the writer or I send notes to the writer and explain to them what I need the line to do in order to set up the choice, in order to set up a free walk scenario. But I don't rewrite it myself.
How many narrative designers do you have?
I think there are 17 of us.
Wow.
But that is the entire design department. Okay. We all have that title, if that makes sense. And then, for example, I do some level design, I do some systems design, and I do some combat design, but primarily I'm focused on narrative.
Julie, is your design process similar or different than Emily's?
Well, it depends on the project I'm on, and it depends on what my tasks are on that project. Right now, it varied a lot. I'm someone that needs to do a lot of research. I need to, I'm like a sponge. I absorb everything, and then I absorb, and at 11 p.m., just like Emily, something will come out eventually, which is a weird Frankenstein of everything that I've read and heard and discussed with people. And so whether it's world building or whether it's, because I remember in ACU when we did the, when we came up with the murder mysteries, I don't know if you remember them.
Yes, we do.
So, me and the actually, I was called a level designer team lead at that point, and I was working closely with the level design director and the writer, and we and people also from the Toronto office came up with the mysteries, because I mean, the city was awesome, and Vidocq is such an interesting character. How could we not, right? And so we decided to try something different with different verbs besides, I mean, doing the parkour or, well, stabbing or killing. And we tried to gamify deduction. And so our process at that point was completely different. I mean, it was, we played a lot of the tabletop Sherlock Holmes. I don't know if you played it.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the one with the map and the newspaper.
Yes, yes. And so that was really our inspiration for that. So we played a lot, and then we watched a lot of Sherlock Holmes movies and Vidocq movies, and we read a lot about investigation and crime scene investigation, the history of crime scene investigation. And eventually we came up with that little like quest design. So the and then again on some other projects I'll be called to work more on not building characters but providing framework to build characters. And it's the same thing for all the narrative designers and narrative director here at Ubisoft. Depending on your skills, you will not do the same thing from one project to the other. I know some are really focused on realization and cinematics and casting, and others are really focused on world building. So depending on what the project needs, they'll choose a narrative designer that fits the needs of the project.
Huh. I didn't know that.
Well, that it's something that's maybe just at UB, I'm not sure. And since right now the narrative job here is really soaring because of the world building, so a lot of new skills are being added to it. So some people that are more comfortable with the realization portion are not comfortable with the world building. So we kind of have a few different type of narrative designers here.
That's cool.
Just like level designers. I mean, some level designers are very, very technical, and they're outstanding in doing very technical stuff. And others are very, very strong on environmental storytelling. So, of course, we're going to give them mandate that make their skills shine. Same with narrative directors. Well, narrative designers, sorry.
Actually, I wanted to ask about narrative directors. Like, what does being an assistant narrative director entail?
Well, since the title is fairly new once again. It's only just a few years old. Every narrative designer associate or assistant narrative director is pushing like his own skills into the title. The ones I work with were all very like the narrative director, usually oversees like the story and will work with the writers and will find systems or ways of delivery of the story that are new and emergent. And the narrative director associate or associate narrative director usually takes portions of the world to build or different characters. So they'll take a subset of the whole narrative family jobs. I don't touch. Usually I will not go into casting and I do not do any writing because I'm not a writer. I mean, the writers do it 1,000 times better than I do. But I focus on what I think my strengths are as a designer.
What do you think your strengths are?
Thinking of a systemic concept like the murder mystery, for example, and trying to find novel ways of helping the player tell his own story inside our big worlds, or just building the world, which is something that I really, really enjoy. Building consistency.
Emily, do you know your strengths offhand?
I would say my personal one. And once again, the type of narrative design that I do at Telltale is much less world building and much more scene construction, just because of the nature of our games. I think my strength is scenes where I'm trying to elicit empathy for the NPCs from the player character, where the type of conversation the player character is having with the NPCs is intimate in nature. And I don't necessarily mean romantic. I mean, where they're trying to talk about something deep. I love subtext more than pretty much anything else in the world. So anytime I can make a scene where you have to talk around what the NPC really obviously wants to talk about to get them to open up to you or to get them to shut down completely forever, I would say that's my personal favorite type of thing to work on.
Do you have any examples from the previous games you've worked on?
Yeah, I mean, and this one is a romance example, but the scene I'm most proud of that I've been able to ship at Telltale was the scene between Batman and Catwoman in her apartment in Batman Episode 3, where Batman is lying half naked on Selina's couch and he's injured. He can't really move. And they have a conversation about how they're the only two people they know who, you know, dress up in black superhero suits and go out in the city at night. And you as the player have a chance to open up to her. And if you do, she kind of confesses to you that her life feels a bit empty. Like she's doing this and she doesn't really know why. And you can kind of agree with that or not. And depending on what you do, it can lead to a friendly drink or a sexual encounter for the two of them. And we did put in a little voyeuristic moment in there. I won't lie. It's still sex in a video game. There's only so much I can do. But then in the morning, you wake up as Bruce and you're just in your underwear and you have to walk around her house looking at stuff to make yourself a bagel sandwich, which pitching that was a lot of fun. I was like, so Batman's half naked and he's trying to make breakfast. It's going to be great, I swear. But it's fun because you got to notice like, wait, I'm also hot and interesting. And Selina is a multifaceted character, not just Catwoman with a half unzipped shirt. And to me, working on that was so rewarding. I spent an immense amount of time on that. And people seem to like it. So that was cool.
And do you think that there's something with the way Telltale handles storytelling, either in development or in the games themselves that the rest of the industry could benefit from?
I would say the thing we do that's probably the most different is our writer involvement. We have a ton of writers, like I mentioned before. They're all exceptional. I love our writers so much. And they are integral in planning the story from day one. A lot of the, well, like I said, it's not the same kind of world building, obviously, because we're working within licensed IP most of the time. But the writers are integral in that. A lot of what they do at Telltale would be considered narrative design at other companies, which is great. Yeah.
And I asked the same question to Julie. Like, is there anything that Ubisoft does with how they handle their teams that you think would benefit the rest of the industry?
Besides
being enormous.
Well, there are smaller teams that are coming out with really interesting projects. I mean, if you look at Child of Light, I mean, it was a smaller project, and it was they really tried something different, and the result is entirely different from if you think of Assassin's Creed or Watch Dogs. I mean, it feels different, it looks different. There's a different approach. One thing that I really really like that they did, they had like a very strong world where they defined the tropes really well, and they like to dress up the world. They worked with a musician here in Montreal. She's not local because she's popular in France, so I guess it's not only in Canada, but and she understood the game. She's a gamer herself, and her music brings depth to the world and to the gameplay. It's really interesting. So I think besides, it's not a question of being enormous. What I think, and I hope in the coming years, we'll be able to you know, really push forward with our games, is the fact that, yes, we have open games. Yes, we have a great story. Yes, we have, you know, the cinematics. But also, once you're done with your game, I mean, you will be able to continue playing over and over and over again and find new things and new water cooler moment every day, because they're just going to be hiding everywhere. And that, I mean, it's a significant plus when you think about, I mean, you're paying $70 for the game. So maybe you're getting a little more there.
Yeah. A question for both of you. Are there any tools in the storytelling toolbox that you feel are underutilized or overutilized in today's games?
It's hard to answer and not make enemies here.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
Exactly. It's a very, very, very tricky question. I'm going to put myself on a limb here. And we rely a lot on cinematics. And they are beautiful. They are breathtaking. But they are very costly. Mm-hmm. They cost a lot of money. They cost a lot of time. They cost a lot of people working on them. And the fact is, until we find a way of building those so they can really nicely and beautifully adapt to the player's progression, they will remain static. So you might have a branch where, depending on what you do, you get a different cinematic. But that cinematic might not really change a lot, you know? So I think if there's a tool in the toolbox that's maybe not, I'm not saying less cinematic, because I think they are, I mean, up until a certain point, some people were purchasing, you know, games because they knew they had nice cinematic in there. But producing those cinematics sometimes force us to stay on a more linear path than we'd like. So I hope I haven't made any enemies here.
That's nothing new.
Okay. So one thing I'd love to see more of, and this kind of goes back to how much I like working on romance content, is post-romance and post-making the friendship content. In a lot of games, you know, get to have a romance with the person, you get to kiss them, or you get to marry them, or have sex with them once or twice, and then it's kind of over. Mm. Like, you did it. Or even if the person is your best friend, you get the loyalty missions with them or whatever they may be. That was not meant to be a specific BioWare call out. but there's an end point there, and there's a point where it stops evolving. And I think in a lot of ways that's necessary because you can't make a million hours of content with each character, but there certainly is a trend for stopping at the point that it feels the relationship, platonic or romantic, has reached its height. And I'd love to see more games delve into stories of like what happens with a character you've been married to for a few years. Obviously, Uncharted 4 did this really nicely. It's a relationship in the middle instead of at the beginning. But there's not a ton of that. And I think that's one of many, many reasons there is so much fan fiction out there. I'm going to bring that up. People want to see more from the characters they love. And I think to bring up BioWare in the really good way, that's what their Citadel DLC did so incredibly well.
Yeah.
For Mass Effect 3, you got to go back and just have a party with everybody and chill. And that brings me to the other thing I'd love to see in more video games is downtime with the characters you really like. Obviously, there's a lot to be learned storytelling-wise from going into combat with people, but there's also a lot to be learned from sitting around a campfire with them. And especially when it comes to creating content that is targeted more at female gamers, which in general is something I'd love to see more in the industry. I think, and this is off the cuff, this is not based on a survey or anything. From my experience, a lot more female gamers do tend to prefer moments of quiet where they can just talk to everybody in the game, where they can learn to know these people better and delve more into the lore, both of the place and the NPCs. I'd like to see a lot more of that. I think that does so much for narrative. I think that does so much for helping the player care about why they're there and why they're hanging out in this space with these people.
Well, it definitely helps the immersion. And yeah. I have to second that because I like to be intellectually engaged with the game I'm playing. Mm-hmm. And that helps a lot. I mean, the relationship, dwelling inside the lore and taking time to observe. And I mean, that activity is being rewarded by the game itself by providing me like the content that I'm looking for and to see like the outcomes that I'm looking for. I mean, that's for sure something I'd like to see more.
Yeah, and working with that, when I'm designing conversations, I try and think about them in similar ways to how I would design levels in a more traditional game, stay with me, where if you pursue specific lines of conversation, you can find that little side path that's going to give you the coolest weapon or a bonus that's not the main trunk of the story, but instead of something that would help you with combat, like a cool weapon or a bonus, you get, you know, character backstory or learning their favorite color or something like that, that can help you down the line. I'm a huge fan of minority content, things that, you know, only 2-5% of players are going to see. Yes. I think that makes narrative design work for people. I think that makes games feel more personalized a lot of the time, even than getting to make big choices. And yeah, more of that.
And more of content that the production feels fine of a very small percentage of player actually seeing. Because most of the time, I mean, you'll create it because, I mean, well, you're a number one fan for it. But down the line in the production, well, I mean, it's the first thing that's going to be cut because, I mean, they're going to say, well, are we going to put resources on something that maybe not 100% or 75% of the player will see? So that's a risk there. So we need the workforce to work on something that 100% of the players will see. So, I mean, it's as an industry, we have to accept that those little pearls for want of a better word, are what build like the stronger worlds. I mean, if you have those little things lying around, in the end, it only helps like the global immersion of everyone.
I agree, and trying to come up with the case for why you should keep moments like that is always a struggle because it's a huge uphill battle. And I get why. Games are unbelievably expensive to make, and there's often not a lot of time, and things like that can fall by the wayside for a million extremely valid reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people are starting to notice how much of a difference that makes. And I'm optimistic that we'll get more of that.
And I remember in AC3, well, a lot of that was cut because, I mean, the production was gigantic. It was huge. And on my plate, I had all the very, very small, well, they were bigger, but eventually they, because of the production and how the project was going, they became smaller. They were all like the myths, the American myths. So in the end, we had the headless horseman driving on, but I mean it was maybe the quarter of what it was supposed to be originally. So we did manage to put the whole horseman and the sea monster and everything. It went to the game, but if the production value and the realization on it had been what maybe a few months more into production, we would have been able to bring it like to be really memorable. Now only I don't know how many people actually saw those little moments, and they were really, we were able to put them, but really, really late in the production.
And I wanted to go backtrack a bit to when we were all talking about downtime in games. Why do you think that more games don't emphasize downtime? Is it because it's hard to gamify that, or maybe because the studios don't trust the players will enjoy that as much as shooting people or something?
I think there are a number of reasons. I think questioning whether the players will enjoy that as much as shooting people is definitely valid and
yes.
Probably is brought up
yes.
A lot. I think also it's really hard to make downtime story critical or plot critical. Often it's a deviation from plot instead, which makes it feel less compelling. Like if you don't need to get it done, if it's not rewarding you XP, for the player who's really like gaming it, why would they do it? So it often has to be optional content. So then on top of this isn't as interesting, you have the a lot of players won't do this problem. And then you get into the why should we produce this then? And then also, especially if you have a game where the characters are voiced, that makes your voice actor budget much higher, which is a higher production cost than many other things. So yeah, there's just a number of reasons why I think places don't do that. And that list is certainly not exhaustive.
Do you have any additional reasons, Julie?
Well, the first reason for me, it is really something that's important because a lot of people are asking, well, will people get it? Will people, you know, read it? Will people, because I mean, in traditional games, you don't have that. If you're playing Gears of War, I don't think there's no downtime at all. So if you're looking at historically what the players who are buying games are actually doing, well, they aren't doing any downtime because they aren't any. So if you're introducing some, it's going on the leap that you will be, you know, that this content will be pleasing players. But then again, it might be pleasing players that aren't playing games right now. And that's an interesting question. I mean, mm-hmm. there's, if you look at, I don't know how many copies a game can fetch, like if you're looking at the pool of players, what, 15 million, 18 million, something like that. But how many people are there that would like to be playing games and that aren't playing games because the games out there aren't appealing to them? Would downtime be appealing to them? Would they like to get involved in that kind of game? And would they start you know, buying games if that was offered to them. So it's a question that I'm often asking myself, because I know I would definitely do it, and I know that's definitely something that I'd like to see in game. And it's not right now, because for the exact reasons that Emily mentioned. I mean, is it appealing? And if it's there, it's optional, because we're afraid that some players might not be interested in it.
Yeah, and I think trying to say in a game pitch, this will be interesting to the type of people who don't generally buy our games, is really hard.
It is.
It's really, really hard. Anytime I've thought about doing that, frankly, I don't even usually have the courage, because I know it's not going to work. Because there is an idea of who gamers are and what type of people buy video games. And I think that in a lot of ways, when executives are thinking about that, they're correct, if that makes sense. Like the type of games that come out on consoles, first of all, you have to own a console. So there's step one. And then it has to look like something that is going to appeal to you. So especially if you're working within a known IP or a franchise, if suddenly you're like, oh, by the way, this is super targeted at teenage girls for this one phase, then everyone goes, what? I not that I've seen anybody do this, probably, because of all the reasons we've said. That's no longer as safe of a bet, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah.
There's so many reasons why this isn't being done, but there's so many people within the industry who care about it and want more downtime that, like I said, I think it's going to start happening, but I might be being overly optimistic.
I feel like it's happening more these days. And
yeah.
Well, I join you.
Yeah.
In your overly optimistic demonstration, because I feel the same way.
Because, like, you mentioned Gears of War, and I haven't played it, but I'm fairly certain the new Gears of War has many moments of downtime. And
it actually does.
Yeah.
I love it. It's a fantastic game, and I hadn't played Gears since the second one, and back then I just did shooting, but 4 has a really great story.
It does.
Didn't expect it. Yeah.
I played 1, 2, 3. I haven't played 4.
I was so pleasantly surprised.
No, I'm curious.
Yeah. And I'm not knocking on Gears. They're great shooters, but it wasn't what I thought it was going to be when I bought it. It still delivered on the shooting, totally. But the story on top of it was substantially better than anything else I'd seen from the franchise.
I was impressed with Uncharted 4. It has the least amount of combat in any of the Uncharteds. And in my opinion, it's the best one because of that, even though I would still prefer less combat, probably zero combat in those games. But I don't think I don't see any studios taking that example as like, maybe you should put less combat in your games.
Or even, I would think that an argument you could make for having those downtime moments is just for pacing's sake.
Where reflection. What? Reflection.
Yeah. Of just like a roller coaster where you get to the high of shooting people, then you have to downtime so that the higher points hit harder and it gives people time to refresh and get their mindset again.
Mm-hmm.
But I think with games like there's more and more on Steam every day. I mean, if you think about Dear Hester and The Vanishing of Ethan Carter and mm-hmm. I mean, all these games, they're basically that. They're experimenting without the verbs shooting or killing, and they're wielding, you know, a significant fan base. So having groundbreaking titles like that, even though that they're not, there might not be in the 15 or 18 million, or they might not be appealing to the exact like audience of the AAA games, but integrating what they do best and learning from them and learning from what they're doing. And I think like the end of Uncharted 4 does it really well also. I mean, it's purely exploration and it's fan service too, because you get all these great things from the past Uncharted and there's no combat and you still learn and there's beauty in learning and in discovering like the... You see more and more, and I hope there's... That's going to sound repetitive, but I hope there's more coming, because it adds a lot. It's when you have the emotion at 10 all the time, you don't feel it anymore. Like when your graph of emotion is through the roof, eventually it gets dulling. So these moments, these peaceful moments of discovery, they make the more challenging moment more entertaining because of the variation.
It has to be getting better. If Gears of War is doing it now, it has to be getting better everywhere.
I was going to say another example of that I found very impressive recently in Witcher 3. Just the story mode that they have. You still have to do the combat, but it's set to easy enough that if you're walking up to a monster at around the correct level, you can just kind of kill it in 4 hits and be done and move on to the actual story part of it that you want to do. There's not a lot of combat challenge. So if that's not your thing, you can basically breeze through Witcher 3 ignoring that element of gameplay completely, or you can make it super, super hard. And I hadn't seen a big game like that, and probably some others have done it, but I hadn't seen a big game like that have that easy of an easy mode. And I loved it. It made it much easier. For example, my husband played that game first, so I saw a lot of the early story moments and I kind of wanted to breeze through. So I put it on that simple setting and I was able to get what I needed out of it. And then when I wanted to make the combat a bit more challenging, I just changed it. And that made the entire story so much more compelling because I walked into it feeling a bit more like a badass and got to skip some of the grindy bits.
Did you beat the game?
I actually have not. It's so long and I have so little time to play games that unfortunately, I have not yet. I want to.
We finally managed to beat it like 2 months ago, and I'll be vague about this so it doesn't spoil listeners or you, Emily, but it does one thing that no big budget game has really done, which I loved, was you're in the climax of the story and you're about to finish the game, and the game has these optional bits where you can just go and interact with characters that you met earlier in the story and just like close off their stories, and they're not big gameplay, most you're just talking to people, but it's so good on a narrative level where it's like, oh, it's just a little pleasant conversation right now. Go see these people. And
I could say goodbye to this person.
Yeah. It was just an amazing feeling I got. And then, okay, I'm going to go finish the game now. I'm all ready for it now.
Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And going along with that, actually, the ending of, did you play Witcher 2?
No.
Okay. I'm going to spoil something about the ending because it was just such great storytelling. I'm so sorry. The final boss in Witcher 2 is another Witcher. And instead of fighting him, you can say, screw it, sit down and drink vodka with him and have a conversation as you both like stare out into the distance.
That's great.
So you don't have to fight to beat the game.
Yep. You can just say, screw it. I don't want to do this last fight. I didn't really want to fight you. And the game ends.
That's even more impressive for how long ago delightful. That game came out.
Yeah.
How much of a fight do you think they had to do to get that in the game?
I don't know. I'm not sure what their process is like at CD Projekt Red. There are so many quirky things in those games that I wonder if that's more of just how they try and design things. I don't know.
We'll eventually get one of them on here.
So, Emily, you brought this question up earlier, but for both of you, since you're both at opposite sides of the spectrum in terms of the size and types of games you both work on, is there anything about the other's narrative sandbox that you're envious of?
Well, yeah, I kind of mentioned this earlier. Obviously, Telltale Games don't offer a lot for emergent storytelling. We're much more of branched linear storytelling as opposed to allowing you to find your own individual narrative. Like there is only a certain number of narratives you can find in a Telltale game. Also, since we mostly do licensed IP, our world building obviously is much different because we're not starting from scratch. We're being handed the history and legacy of a number of characters and being asked to work within certain conventions of how their world functions. And I think it's really cool that you get to do the opposite of that.
As a fan of Puzzle Agent, I would hope that you get to do more original content someday.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't done a Telltale original content game. I'm working on my third one there right now. So who knows?
I have no idea. I'm envious of your format, because the episodic format is amazing. I mean, I remember when I played The Wolf Among Us, I felt like I was binging on Netflix. Like I sat down, I downloaded the episodes, and it felt good. Like the format, the length of the episode, the fact that there's a recap at the beginning, and that I love it. You're in a different relation with your medium. It's not like sitting down and playing. Like, okay, I'm loading my game. I'm just going to play for 6, 7, or 8 hours. It's not that the format is small. It's intense. It's nice. And you know something's going to happen at the end of an hour and a half or an hour and 15 minutes. Because, I mean, the cliffhanger is right there, right? So that's something that I really love. Also, well, and that's something we'll never be able to do. Because, I mean, there's only one person that does it. It's the one that did it first, right? So the first Walking Dead, I mean, that for me, it was just, wow, it's different. It's, you know, it was something that was groundbreaking. So it's really props. It was good. No, but
I didn't work on that one. But the people I work with did, and they did an incredible job.
Having to set a standard in, yeah. You know, I mean, it was, everybody looked up to the first Walking Dead and said, okay, this is something we need to, you know, not copy, but we need to achieve something on that level. And that's, mm-hmm. that says a lot.
I will say, on top of that, I think that other companies that are trying to do episodic stories right now and branching stories, probably the two biggest call outs I would have here would be Until Dark and Life is Strange. Mm. I'm so glad they're doing it because more people other than us need to be doing it for all of us to grow. Mm. And I thought both of those games were fantastic. So, I'm intrigued to see what other companies choose to follow a more Telltale-esque format in times to come. And I really look forward to learning from what they put out.
I'm happy you mentioned Life is Strange, because earlier on when I was talking about how do you validate the player's output on his mental skills or mental, mm-hmm. well, mental challenge, having the player backtrack in time to the moment where he thinks he could have done a difference into interacting with someone, mm-hmm. is a fantastic novel way of, you know, testing the player's output. I love that game. It's great.
Yeah. And as someone who came out of educational games, specifically making educational games to teach people how to have difficult conversations about things like mental health. I was so glad they did that, because it's actually a learning experience, mm-hmm. for the person in the chair. They're very often at Telltale, and just in my own personal game design idea, I try to make there not be a wrong answer of how you deal with situations. And I do a lot of tabletop games. I Dungeon Master for D&D and that kind of thing a lot. I try to make sure there's no wrong way to go about solving a problem, but I think in Life is Strange, they handled having a wrong way really well, because you could go back and try again and learn what worked and what didn't. Yeah, I thought that was deeply impressive.
I think this will be like our last question, but since we've been talking so much about different games, are there any other games that you can think of that are advancing storytelling or trying out new things in storytelling that you'd want to mention?
Oh, there's so many.
Well, it's big, but anyways, I'll say it because it's funny. There's a funny story to it. In World of Warcraft, yes, it's been out for 12 years. Yes, it's been vanilla, and then it's been nerfed, and you can say whatever you want about World of Warcraft, but I played a lot, more than I wish to admit. And the funny thing is, the guild I was with, of course we did end content and we were really hardcore players, but we were also a very role-playing oriented guild. And the world was rich enough for us to do our own games in it. We did scavengers hunt. We had costume parties. And right now I'm playing with my daughter, and she's only 3. And it's fascinating to see that she can enjoy that game without even getting into combat with anything. The world is rich enough for her to discover. Yes, she well, I mean, I don't bring her in in Ice Crown Citadel because I don't want her to be afraid. But I mean, the starting zones, and it's beautiful to see her interact with the world without killing or without anything and still having a very interesting experience for a three-year-old. So, I mean, rich, vast worlds where you can hold your own narrative inside, I mean, that's something I really wish there'd be more of. And I mean, World of Warcraft has that because the world is so big and so complete and the lore is so deep that you can virtually do anything in there. We play hide and seek. I mean, it's funny because we play our own games inside the game.
That's awesome. So kind of on the opposite side of the spectrum, it goes back to I don't design open world games. One game that really stood out for me this year was Mystic Messenger.
Oh, yes.
The mobile game. First of all, I have sunk an embarrassing amount of hours and dollars into that game. But the real-time aspect of it was done so well. Mm-hmm. And once you got deep enough into it, it felt so much like you were talking to real people while still being goofy and fun. But then it got surprisingly dark at different moments. And it just... it was very popular among people I know who really enjoy visual novels, but a lot of people I never expected to get particularly into it were extremely enchanted by that game. And along with Mystic Messenger, we Telltale published this, but we didn't design it. The Mr. Robot game came out this past year that was designed by Night Schoolers. I never get the name of it right. It's like 51 Exfiltration something. It was a similar format where it was a story told through text messages, and it made you feel like you were a badass hacker person, even though you were just sending prescribed text messages within a game. And I think what those two games did really well is because they were for phones, you sitting on your couch were the character in the game. At no point were you theoretically walking into another space until in Mystic Messenger at the very end of it, they did that a little bit. They started showing like pictures of your player character on the screen. But it felt like an emerging story that included you, your physical being. And I'm very excited to see where that type of mobile game goes in the next couple of years.
Well, I mean, because Mystic Messenger almost borders with ARG.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating because you're reaching out to you're reaching out to players that aren't playing consoles and that aren't maybe PC gamers, but that do want to play, that do want to play with relationships. And I mean, it opens up a door of possibilities.
I think it's a good way to end this then. A door of possibilities.
I could say it in French. It makes sense. But anyways.
No, it does. No, I'm not making fun of you.
No, it's fine.
So since we're at the end, Julie, I don't know how much this question applies to you, but for both of you, where can people find you on the internet?
My Twitter handle is Emily, E-M-I-L-Y, Buck, B-U-C-K, Shot, S-H-O-T. My maiden name was Buck. And then that's also my Tumblr and Instagram handle.
Put them in the show notes.
I tweet way too many pictures of Pokemon things.
No, you don't.
These days. And I play trashy visual novels sometimes and post about that too. Yeah, come find me. I'm nice. I'll answer tweets if you tweet at me. As long as they're not telling me I'm trash or something.
Julie, you're not on Twitter, right?
I'm not. No, I'm on. Well, I'm blogging, but in French. So so there might be a language barrier, but I'm
What's
on...
What's the blog's name?
Mine, yeah. My personal blog was Parfois Fantastic, which is sometimes fantastic. And otherwise, I also blog on a platform that's called TPL Moms. So, and I talk about genders and games and how it affects our kids and stuff like that.
Cool. That's really cool.
I'll put links in the show notes for him.
Sure, will do.
And you can find this podcast on Twitter at ScriptBlockCast. And if all goes well, this will be the last episode of the year. And if you like this episode, leave a review on iTunes, please. And with that, thank you two for both coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you.